Of course he loves you. Everyone in the whole world loves you.
Impulsively, as if to prove her point, she kissed his pale cheek fondly. The Gorham smiled at her.
Dear child, he observed. Your own heart is so open that you automatically assume that everyone loves those whom you love. It is not always that way, I'm afraid. There are a good number of people in our caves who are not all that fond of me.
Nonsense,
she said.
Just because you argue with someone does not mean that you do not love him. I love my father very much, but we fight all the time. We enjoy fighting with each other.
Tenedra knew that she was safe using such terms as silly and nonsense with the Gorham. She had by now so utterly charmed him that she was quite sure she could get away with almost anything. Although it might have been difficult to persuade anyone around her that such was the case, there had been a few distinct but subtle changes in Tenedra's behavior. Impulsive though she might seem to these serious, reserved people, she now gave at least a moment's thought, however brief, before acting or speaking. She had on occasion embarrassed herself here in the caves, and embarrassment was the one thing Tenedra absolutely could not bear. Gradually, imperceptibly, she learned the value of marginal self-control, and sometimes she almost appeared ladylike. She had also had time to consider the problem of Geryon. His absence during the long weeks had been particularly, inexplicably painful for her. It was as if she had misplaced something, something very valuable, and its loss left an aching kind of vacancy. Her emotions had always been such a jumble that she had never fully come to grips with them. Usually they changed so rapidly that she never had time to examine one before another took its place. This yearning sense of something missing, however, had persisted for so long that she finally had to face it. It could not be love. That was impossible. Love for a peasant scullion, no matter how nice he was quite out of the question. She was, after all, an imperial princess, and her duty was clear. If there had been even the faintest suspicion in her mind that her feelings had moved beyond casual friendship, she would have had an absolute obligation to break off any further contact. Tenedra did not want to send Geryon away and never see him again. The very thought of doing so made her lip tremble. So, quite obviously, what she felt was not, in fact could not, be love. She felt much better once she had worked that out. The possibility had been worrying her. But now that logic had proved beyond all doubt that she was safe, she was able to relax. It was a great comfort to have logic on her side. That left only the waiting, the seemingly endless, unendurable waiting for her friends. Where were they? When were they coming back? What were they doing out there that could take so long? The longer she waited, the more frequently her newfound self-control deserted her, and her pale-skinned companions learned to watch apprehensively for those minute danger signs that announced imminent eruption. Then, finally, the Gorham told her that word had reached him that her friends were returning, and the little princess went absolutely wild with anticipation. Her preparations were lengthy and elaborate. She would greet them properly, of course. No little girl enthusiasm this time. Instead, she would be demure, reserved, imperial, and altogether grown up. Naturally, she would have to look the part. She fretted for hours before selecting the perfect gown, a floor-length Ulgo dress of glistening white. Ulgo gowns, however, were perhaps a trifle too modest for Tenedra's taste. While she wished to appear reserved, she did not want to be that reserved. Thoughtfully, she removed the sleeves from the gown and made a few modifications to the neckline. some elaborate cross-tying at bodice and waist, with a slender gold sash accentuated things a bit. Critically, she examined the results of her efforts and found them to her liking. Then there was the problem of her hair. The loose, tumbled style she had always worn would never do. It needed to be up, piled in a soft mass of curls atop her head, and then cascading elegantly down over one shoulder to add that splash of color across the pristine whiteness of her bodice that would set things off just right. She worked on it until her arms ached from being raised over her head for so long. When she was finished, she studied the entire effect of gown and hair and demurely regal expression. It wasn't bad, she congratulated herself. Geryon's eyes would fall out when he saw her. The little princess exulted. When the day finally arrived, Tenedra, who had scarcely slept, sat nervously with the Gorum in his now familiar study. He was reading from a long scroll, rolling the top with one hand, while he unrolled the bottom with another. As he read, the princess fidgeted, nibbling absently on a lock.
"You seem restless today, child," he observed.
"Well, it's just that I have not seen them, for so long," she explained quickly. "Are you sure I look all right?"
She had only asked the question 6 or 8 times that morning already.
"You are lovely, child," he assured her once again. She beamed at him.
A serving man came into the Gorum's study.
"Your guests have arrived, Holy One," he said with a respectful bow.
Tenedra's heart began to pound.
"Shall we go greet them, child?"
the Gorum suggested, laying aside his scroll and rising to his feet. Tenedra resisted her impulse to spring from her chair and run out of the room. With an iron grip, she controlled herself. Instead, she walked at the Gorum's side, silently repeating to herself,
"Dignity, reserve, imperially demure."
Her friends were travel-stained and weary-looking as they entered the Gorum's cavern. And there were strangers with them Tenedra did not recognize. Her eyes, however, sought only one face. He looked older than she remembered him. His face, which had always been so serious, had a gravity to it now that had not been there before. Things had obviously happened to him while he had been gone. Important things. And the princess felt a little pang at having been excluded from such momentous events in his life. And then her heart froze. Who was that great gangling girl at his side? And why was he being so deferential to the big cow? Tenedra's jaws clenched as she glared across the calm waters of the lake at the perfidious young man. She had known it would happen. The minute she had let him out of her sight, he had run headlong into the arms of the first girl who happened by. How dared he? How dared he? She thought again. As the group on the far side of the lake began to come across the causeway, Tenedra's heart sank. The tall girl was lovely. Her dark hair was lustrous, and her features were perfect. Desperately, Tenedra looked for some flaw, some blemish, and the way the girl moved. She actually seemed to flow with a grace that nearly brought tears of despair to Tenedra's eyes. The greetings and introductions seemed hardly more than some incoherent babble to the suffering princess. Absently, she curtsied to the king of the Algars and his lovely queen. Politely, she greeted the lushly beautiful woman, Taiba, her name was, whom Lady Polgara introduced her to. The moment she was dreading was approaching, and there was no way she could forestall it.
"And this is Adara," Lady Polgara said, indicating the lovely creature at Geryon's side.
Tenedra wanted to cry.
It wasn't fair. Even the girl's name was beautiful. Why couldn't it have been something ugly?
"Adara," Lady Polgara continued, her eyes intently on Tenedra's face.
"This is Her Imperial Highness, the Princess Tenedra."
Adara curtsied with a grace that was like a knife in Sanedra's heart.
"I have so wanted to meet your highness,"
the tall girl said, her voice vibrant and musical.
"Charmed, I am sure,"
Sanedra replied with a lofty superiority, though every nerve within her screamed with the need to lash out at this detested rival. She held herself rigid and silent. Any outburst, even the faintest trace of dismay showing in her expression or her voice, would make this Adara's victory complete. Sanedra was too much a princess, too much a woman, to permit that ultimate defeat. Though her pain was as real as if she were in the hands of a torturer, she stood erect, enclosed in all of the imperial majesty she could muster. Silently, she began to repeat all of her titles over and over to herself, steeling herself with them, reminding herself grimly just who she was. An imperial princess did not cry. The daughter of Ran Barun did not snivel. The flower of Tol Nedra would never grieve because some clumsy scullery boy had chosen to love someone else.
"Forgive me, Lady Polgara,"
she said, pressing a trembling hand to her forehead.
"But I suddenly seem to have the most dreadful headache. Would you excuse me, please?"
Without waiting for an answer, she turned to walk slowly toward the Gorim's house. She paused only once, just as she passed Geryon.
"I hope that you will be very happy,"
she lied to him. He looked baffled. It had gone too far. It had been absolutely necessary to conceal her emotions from Adara, but this was Geryon, and she had to let him know exactly how she felt.
"I despise you, Geryon,"
she whispered at him with a terrible intensity,
"and I don't ever want to lay eyes on you again."
He blinked.
"I don't think you can even begin to imagine how much I loathe the very sight of you," she added.
And with that, she continued on into the Gorim's house, her back straight and her head unbowed. Once she was inside, she fled to her room, threw herself on the bed, and wept in broken-hearted anguish. She heard a light step near the doorway, and then the Lady Polgara was there.
"All right, Sanedra. What is this all about?"
She sat down on the edge of the bed and put one hand on the shoulder of the sobbing little princess.
"Oh, Lady Polgara,"
Sanedra wailed, suddenly throwing herself into Polgara's arms.
I have lost him. He's in love with her."
"And who is that, dear?" Polgara asked her calmly.
"Geryon. He's in love with that Adara, and he doesn't even know that I'm alive anymore."
"Oh, you silly little goose," Polgara chided her gently.
"Well, he does love her, doesn't he?"
Sanedra demanded.
"Of course he does, dear."
"I knew it,"
Sanedra wailed, collapsing into a fresh storm of weeping.
"It's only natural for him to love her," Polgara continued. "She is his cousin, after all."
"His cousin?"
Sanedra's tear-streaked face came up suddenly.
"The daughter of his mother's sister," Polgara explained. "You did know that Geryon's mother was an Algar, didn't you?"
Sanedra shook her head mutely.
"Is that what all of this is about?"
Sanedra nodded. Her weeping had suddenly stopped. Lady Polgara took a handkerchief from her sleeve and offered it to the tiny girl.
"Blow your nose, dear," she instructed. "Don't sniff like that. It's very unbecoming."
Sanedra blew her nose.
"And so you have finally admitted it to yourself,"
Polgara observed.
"I was wondering how long it was going to take you."
"Admitted what?"
Polgara gave her a long, steady look, and Sanedra flushed slowly, lowering her eyes.
"That's better," Polgara said. "You mustn't try to hide things from me, Sanedra. It doesn't do any good, you know, and it only makes things more difficult for you."
Sinedra's eyes had widened as the full impact of her tacit admission struck her.
"It is not possible,"
she gasped in absolute horror.
It can't be.
As my father is so fond of saying, just about anything is possible, Bulgara told her.
What am I going to do?
First, you ought to go wash your face, Bulgara told her. Some girls can cry without making themselves ugly, but you don't have the right coloring for it. You're an absolute fright. I'd advise you never to cry in public if you can help it.
That is not what I meant, Tenedra said. What am I going to do about Geryon?
Oh, I don't know that you really need to do anything, dear. Things will straighten themselves out, eventually.
But I am a princess, and he's... Well, he's just Geryon. This sort of thing is not permitted.
Everything will probably turn out all right, Lady Polgara assured her. Trust me, Tenedra. I have been handling matters like this for a very long time. Now, go wash your face.
I made a terrible fool of myself out there, didn't I?
Tenedra said.
Oh, it's nothing that can't be fixed,
Polgara said calmly.
We can pass it off as something brought on by the excitement of seeing your friends again after so long. You are glad to see us, aren't you?
Oh, Lady Polgara,
Tenedra said, embracing her and laughing and crying at the same time.
After the ravages of Tenedra's crying fit had been repaired, they rejoined the others in the Gurum's familiar study.
Are you recovered, my child?
The Gurum asked her gently, concern written all over his dear old face.
Just a touch of nerves, Holy One, Lady Polgara reassured him. Our princess, as you have probably noticed, is somewhat high-strung.
I'm so sorry that I ran off like that,
Tenedra apologized to Adara.
It was silly of me. Your Highness could never be silly,
Adara told her. Tenedra lifted her chin.
Oh, yes, I can, she declared. I've got as much right to make a fool of myself in public as anyone else.
Adara laughed, and the entire incident was smoothed over. There was still, however, a problem. Tenedra had, she realized, gone perhaps a bit too far in her impulsive declaration of undying hatred for Geryon. His expression was confused, even a trifle hurt. Tenedra decided somewhat loftily to ignore the injury she had inflicted upon him. She had suffered through that dreadful scene on the shore of the Gorham's Island, and it seemed only fair that he should suffer a little as well. Not too much, of course, but a little, anyway. He did, after all, have it coming. She allowed him a suitable period of anguish. At least she hoped it was anguish. Then spoke to him warmly, even fondly, as if those spiteful words had never passed her lips. His expression became even more baffled, and then she turned the full force of her most winsome smile on him, noting with great satisfaction its devastating effect. After that, she ignored him. While Belgarath and Lady Polgara were recounting the events of their journey to Rakhtal, the princess sat demurely beside Adara on a bench, half listening, but for the most part turning the amazing discovery of the past hour over and over in her mind. Suddenly, she felt eyes on her, and she looked up quickly. The little blonde boy Lady Polgara called Erend was watching her, his small face very serious. There was something about his eyes. With a sudden and absolute certainty, she knew that the child was looking directly into her heart. He smiled at her then. Without knowing why, she felt a sudden overwhelming surge of joy at his smile. He walked toward her, still smiling, and his little hand dipped into the pouch at his waist. He took out a round gray stone and offered it to her.
Erend,
he said. For an instant, Tenedra seemed to see a faint blue flicker deep within the stone.
Do not touch it, Tenedra,
Lady Polgara told her in a tone that made Tenedra's hand freeze in the very act of reaching for the stone.
Dernek,
Lady Polgara said to the smith, with an odd note of complaint in her voice.
Mistress Paul, he said helplessly, I don't know what else to do.
No matter how I seal it up, he always manages to get it open again.
Make him put it away, she told him, with just a hint of exasperation.
Durnick went to the little boy, knelt, and took hold of the pouch. Without a word, he held it open, and the child dropped the stone into it. Durnick tied the pouch shut, pulling the knots as tight as he could. When he had finished, the little boy put his arms affectionately around the smith's neck. Durnick looked a bit embarrassed and was about to lead the child away, but Erend pulled his hand free and climbed instead into Zinedra's lap. Quite seriously, he kissed her, then nestled down in her arms and promptly fell asleep. Feelings moved in Zinedra that she had never felt before. Without knowing why, she was happier than she had ever been in her life. She held the child close against her, her arms protectively about him, and her cheek laid snugly against his pale blonde curls. She felt an impulse to rock him and perhaps to croon a very soft lullaby to him.
"We will have to hurry," Belgarath was saying to the Gorum. "Even with Relg's help, it will take a week or more to reach the Sindarin border. Then we'll have to cross the whole country, and the snow in Sindaria can pile up in a hurry this time of year. To make things even worse, this is the season for storms and the Sea of the Winds, and it is a long way over open water from Sindar to Reva."
The word Reva jerked Zinedra out of her reverie. From the very moment that she and Jeebers had crept from the imperial palace at Tolhonath, one single thought had dominated her thinking. She was not going to Reva. Though she might have seemed on occasion to have surrendered on that point, her acquiescence had always been a subterfuge. Now, however, she would have to take a stand. The reasons for her adamant refusal to obey the provisions of the Accords of Vomimbre were no longer entirely clear to her. So much had happened that she was not even the same person, but one thing was absolutely certain no matter who she was. She was not going to Reva. It was a matter of principle.
I am sure that once we reach Sindaria, I'll be able to make my way to an imperial garrison,
she said, as casually as if the matter had already been decided.
And why would you want to do that, dear?
Lady Polgara asked her.
Well, as I said earlier, I am not going to Reva,
Zinedra replied.
The legionnaires will be able to make arrangements to return me to Tolhonath.
Perhaps you should visit your father,
Polgara said quite calmly.
You mean that you are just going to let me go?
I didn't say that. I am sure we'll be able to find a ship bound for Tolhonath sometime in the late spring or early summer. Raven commerce with the Empire is extensive.
I don't think that you fully understand me, Lady Polgara. I said that I am not going to Reva, under any circumstances.
Oh, I heard you, Zinedra. You are wrong, however. You are going to Reva. You have an appointment there, remember?
I won't go.
Zinedra's voice went up an octave or two.
Yes, you will.
Polgara's voice was deceptively calm, but there was a hint of steel in it.
I absolutely refuse,
the princess declared. She was about to say more, but a small finger gently brushed her lips. The sleepy child in her arms raised his hand to touch her mouth. She moved her head irritably.
I have told you all before that I will not submit to...
The child touched her lips again. His eyes were drowsy as he looked up at her, but his gaze was calm and reassuring. Zinedra forgot what she had been saying.
I am not going to the Isle of the Winds, she concluded rather lamely, and that is final.
The trouble was that it didn't sound all that final. It seems that we have had this discussion once or twice before, Polgara observed.
You have no right to...
Zinedra's words trailed off again as her thoughts went astray once more. The child's eyes were so blue, so very blue. She found herself unable to look away from them and seemed to be sinking into that incredible color.
she shook her head. It was so completely unlike her to keep losing track of an argument this way. She tried to concentrate.
"I refuse to be publicly humiliated," she declared. "I will not stand in the hall of the Raven King like a beggar while all of the Elorns snicker up their sleeves at me."
That was better. Her momentary distraction seemed to be fading. Inadvertently, she glanced down at the child, and it all went out the window again.
"I don't even have the right kind of dress," she added plaintively.
Now, what had made her say that? Olga said nothing, but her eyes seemed very wise as she watched the princess flounder. Tenedra stumbled along, her objections growing less and less relevant. Even as she argued, she realized that there was no real reason for her not going to Reva. Her refusal seemed frivolous, even childish. Why on earth had she made such a fuss about it? The little boy in her arms smiled encouragingly at her, and unable to help herself, she smiled back at him, her defenses crumbling. She made one last try.
"It is only some silly old formality anyway, Lady Palgra. There won't be anyone waiting for me in the Hall of the Raven Kings. There never has been. The Raven line is extinct."
She tore her eyes away from the child's face.
"Do I really have to go?"
Lady Palgra nodded gravely. Tenedra heaved a great sigh. All of this bickering seemed so unnecessary. What was the point of making such an issue of a simple trip? It was not as if there was any danger involved. If it would make people happy, why be so stubborn about it?
"Oh, all right,"
she surrendered.
"If it is so important to everyone, I suppose I can go to Reva."
For some reason, saying it made her feel much better. The child in her arms smiled again, gently patted her cheek, and went back to sleep. Lost in a sudden, inexplicable happiness, the princess nestled her cheek against his curls again and began to rock back and forth gently, crooning very softly. Part 2. Reva. Chapter 9. Once more, Relg led them through the dark, silent world of the caves. And once more, Geryon hated every moment of it. It seemed an eternity ago that they had left Plogu, where Tenedra's farewells to the frail old Gurum had been long and tearful. The princess rather baffled Geryon, and he gave himself over to some speculation about her as he stumbled along in the musty-smelling darkness. Something had happened at Prolgu. In some very subtle ways, Tenedra was different, and the differences made Geryon jumpy for some reason. When at last, after unaccountable days in the dark, twisting galleries, they emerged once again into the world of light and air, it was through an irregular, brush-choked opening in the wall of a steep ravine. It was snowing heavily outside, with large flakes settling softly down through the windless air.
"Are you sure this is Sundario?"
Barak asked Relg as he bowled his way through the obstructing brush at the mouth of the cave. Relg shrugged, once more binding a veil across his face to protect his eyes from the light.
"We are no longer in Ulgo. There are a lot of places that aren't in Ulgo, Relg,"
Barak reminded him sourly.
"It sort of looks like Sundaria,"
King Kohag observed, leaning over in his saddle to stare out of the cave at the softly falling snow.
"Can anybody make a guess at the time of day? It is really very hard to say when it is snowing this hard, Father,"
Hetar told him.
"The horses think that it is about noon, but their idea of time is a bit imprecise."
"Wonderful," Silk noted sardonically. "We don't know where we are or what time it is. Things are getting off to a splendid start."
"It's not really that important, Silk," Belgarath said wearily. All we have to do is go north. We're bound to run into the Great North Road eventually.
Fine, Sulk replied. But, which way is north? Geryon looked closely at his grandfather as the old man squeezed out into the snowy ravine. The old man's face was etched with lines of weariness, and the hollows under his eyes were dark again. Despite the 2 weeks or more of convalescence at the stronghold, and Aunt Paul's considered opinion that he was fit to travel, Belgareth had obviously not yet fully recovered from his collapse. As they emerged from the cave, they pulled on their heavy cloaks and tightened the cinches on their saddles in preparation to move out.
"Uninviting sort of place, isn't it?"
Zenedra observed to Adara, looking around critically. "This is mountain country," Geryon told her quickly, coming to the defense of his homeland. "It's no worse than the mountains of eastern Tolnedra."
"I did not say that it was, Geryon,"
she replied in an infuriating way. They rode for several hours until they heard the sound of axes somewhere off in the forest.
"Woodcutters," Durnick surmised. "I'll go talk with them, get some directions."
He rode off in the direction of the sound. When he returned, he had a slightly disgusted look on his face.
"We've been gone south," he told them.
"Oh, naturally," Silk said sardonically. "Did you find out what time it is?"
"Late afternoon," Durnick told him. "The woodcutters say that if we turn west, we'll strike a road that runs northwesterly. Brings us to the Great North Road, about 20 leagues on this side of Muros." "Let's see if we can find this road before dark, then," Belgareth replied.
It took them several days to ride down out of the mountains, and several more before they had passed through the sparsely inhabited stretches of eastern Sindaria to the more thickly populated plains around Lake Sultern. It snowed intermittently the entire time, and the heavily traveled roads of south-central Sindaria were slushy and lay like ugly brown scars across the snowy hills. Their party was large, and they usually had to split up among several inns in the neat snow-covered villages at which they stopped. Princess Zenedra quite frequently used the word quaint to describe both the villages and the accommodations, and Geryon found her fondness for the word just a trifle offensive. The kingdom through which they traveled was not the same Sindaria he had left more than a year before. Geryon saw quiet evidence of mobilization in almost every village along the way. Groups of country militia drilled in the brown slush in village squares, old swords and bent pikes, long forgotten in dusty attics or damp cellars, had been located and scraped free of rust in preparation for the war that everyone knew was coming. The efforts of these peaceful farmers and villagers to look warlike were often ludicrous. Their homemade uniforms were in every possible shade of red or blue or green, and their bright-colored banners obviously showed that treasured petticoats had been sacrificed to the cause. The faces of these simple folk, however, were serious. The young men strutted in their uniforms for the benefit of village girls, and older men tried to look like veterans. The atmosphere in each village was grave. Sindaria stood quietly on the brink of war. At Sultern, Aunt Paul, who had been looking thoughtfully at each village through which they passed, apparently reached a decision.
"Father," she said to Belgareth as they rode into town, "you and Kohag and the rest go straight on to Sindar. Durnick, Geryon, and I need to make a little side trip."
"Where are you going?"
"To Faldor's farm."
"Faldor's? What for?"
"We all left things behind, Father. You hustled us out of there so fast that we barely had time to pack."
Her tone and expression were so matter-of-fact that Geryon immediately suspected subterfuge, and Belgareth's briefly raised eyebrow indicated that he was also fairly certain that she was not telling him everything.
"We are starting to trim this a bit close, Paul," the old man pointed out.
"There's still plenty of time, Father. It's not really all that far out of our way. We will only be a few days behind you."
Is it really that important, Paul?
Yes, Father. I think it is. Keep an eye on Erend for me, won't you? I don't think he really needs to go with us.
All right, Paul.
A silvery peal of laughter burst from the lips of the Princess Tenedra, who was watching the stumbling efforts of a group of militiamen to execute a right turn without tripping over their own weapons. Aunt Paul's expression did not change as she turned her gaze on the giggling jewel of the Empire.
I think we will take that one with us, however.
Tenedra protested bitterly when she was advised that she would not be traveling directly to the comforts of King Folarak's palace at Sindar, but her objections had no impact on Aunt Paul.
Doesn't she ever listen to anyone?
The little princess grumbled to Geryon as they rode along behind Aunt Paul and Durnik on the road to Medallia.
She always listens,
Geryon replied.
But she never changes her mind, does she?
Not very often.
But she does listen.
Aunt Paul glanced over her shoulder at them.
Pull up your head, Tenedra, she instructed. It is starting to snow again, and I don't want you riding with a wet head.
The princess drew in a quick breath as if preparing to retort.
I wouldn't,
Geryon advised her softly.
But she's not in the mood for a discussion just now.
Tenedra glared at him, but pulled up her hood in silence. It was still snowing lightly when they reached Medallia that evening. Tenedra's reaction to the lodgings offered at the inn was predictable. There was, Geryon had noted, a certain natural rhythm to her outbursts. She never began at the top of her voice, but rather worked her way up to it with an impressively swelling crescendo. She had just reached the point of launching herself into full voice when she was suddenly brought up short.
"What an absolutely charming display of good breeding," Aunt Paul observed calmly to Durnik. "All of Geryon's old friends will be terribly impressed by this sort of thing, don't you think?"
Durnik looked away, hiding a smile.
"Oh, I'm sure of it, Mistress Paul."
Tenedra's mouth was still open, but her tirade had been cut off instantly. Geryon was amazed at her sudden silence.
"I was being a bit silly, wasn't I?"
she said after a moment. Her tone was reasonable, almost sweet-natured.
"Yes, dear, just a bit,"
Aunt Paul agreed. It was perhaps noon of the following day when they turned off of the main road leading to Ararat into the country lane that led to Faldor's farm. Since that morning, Geryon's excitement had risen to almost intolerable heights. Every milepost, every bush and tree was familiar to him now. And over there, wasn't that old Kralto riding an unsaddled horse on some errand for Faldor? Finally, at the sight of a tall, familiar figure clearing brush and twigs from a drainage ditch, he was no longer able to restrain himself. He drove his heels into his horse's flanks, smoothly jumped a fence, and galloped across the snowy field toward the solitary worker.
"Rundereg!"
he shouted, hauling his horse to a stop and flinging himself from the saddle.
"Your honor?"
Rundereg replied, blinking with astonishment.
"Rundereg, it's me, Geryon. Don't you recognize me?"
"Geryon?"
Rundereg blinked several more times, peering intently into Geryon's face. The light dawned slowly in his eyes like a sunrise on a murky day.
"Why, I believe you're right," he marveled. "You are Geryon, aren't you?"
"Of course I am, Rundereg,"
Geryon exclaimed, reaching out to take his friend's hand. But Rundereg shoved both hands behind him and stepped back.
"Your clothing, Geryon. Have a care. I'm all over mud."
"Oh, I don't care about the clothes, Rundereg. You're my friend."
The tall lad shook his head stubbornly.
"You mustn't get mud on them. They're too splendid. Plenty of time to shake hands after I clean up."
He stared curiously at Geryon.
"Where'd you get such fine things? And a sword? You'd better not let Faldor see you wearing a sword. You know he doesn't approve of that sort of thing."
Somehow things were not going the way they were supposed to be going.
"How's Durun?"
Garion asked.
"And Zubret?"
"Durun moved away last summer,"
Runderig replied after a moment's struggle to remember.
"I think his mother remarried. Anyway, they're on a farm down on the other side of Winold. And Zubret? Well, Zubret and I started walking out together not too long after you left."
The tall young man suddenly blushed and looked down in embarrassed confusion.
"There's sort of an understanding between us, Garion," he blurted.
"How splendid, Runderig!"
Garion exclaimed quickly to cover the little dagger cut of disappointment. Runderig, however, had already taken the next step.
"I know that you and she were always fond of each other," he said,
his long face miserably unhappy.
"I'll have a talk with her."
He looked up, tears standing in his eyes.
"It wouldn't have gone so far, Garion, except that none of us thought you were ever coming back."
"Well, I haven't really, Runderig,"
Garion quickly assured his friend.
"We only came by to visit and to pick up some things that we left behind. Then we'll be off again."
"Have you come for Zubret, too?"
Runderig asked in a numb, stricken sort of voice that tore at Garion's heart.
"Runderig,"
he said it very calmly,
"I don't even have a home anymore. One night I sleep in a palace, the next night in the mud beside the road. Would either one of us want that kind of a life for Zubret?"
"I think she'd go with you, if you asked her to, though." "I think she'd endure anything to be with you," said Runderig.
"But we won't let her, will we? So far as we are concerned, the understanding between the two of you is official."
"I could never lie to her, Garion,"
the tall boy objected.
"I could,"
Garion said bluntly.
"Particularly if it will keep her from living out her life as a homeless vagabond. All you have to do is to keep your mouth shut and let me do the talking."
He grinned suddenly.
"Just as in the old days."
A slow smile crept shyly across Runderig's face. The gate of the farm stood open, and good, honest Valdor, beaming and rubbing his hands with delight, was bustling around Aunt Paul, Durnick, and Tenedra. The tall, thin farmer seemed as lean as always, and his long jaw appeared to have grown even longer in the year and more since they had left. There was a bit more gray at his temples, but his heart had not changed. Princess Tenedra stood demurely to one side of the little group, and Garion carefully scanned her face for danger signs. If anyone could disrupt the plan he had in mind, it would most likely be Tenedra. But try though he might, he could not read her face. Then Zubret descended the stairs from the gallery that encircled the interior of the courtyard. Her dress was a country dress, but her hair was still golden, and she was even more beautiful than before. A thousand memories flooded over Garion all at once, together with an actual pain at what he had to do. They had grown up together, and the ties between them were so deep that no outsider could ever fully understand what passed between them in a single glance. And it was with a glance that Garion lied to her. Zubret's eyes were filled with love, and her soft lips were slightly parted, as if almost ready to answer the question she was sure he would ask, even before he gave it voice. Garion's look, however, feigned friendship, affection even, but no love. Incredulity flickered across her face, and then a slow flush. The pain Garion felt as he watched the hope die in her blue eyes was as sharp as a knife. Even worse, he was forced to retain his pose of indifference, while she wistfully absorbed every feature of his face, as if storing up those memories which had to last her a lifetime. Then she turned, and, pleading some errand, she walked away from them. Geryon knew that she would avoid him thereafter, and that he had seen her for the last time in his life. It had been the right thing to do, but it had very nearly broken Geryon's heart. He exchanged a quick glance with Rundorig that said all that needed saying, and then he sadly watched the departure of the girl he had always thought that one day he might marry. When she turned a corner and disappeared, he sighed rather bitterly, turned back and found Zenedra's eyes on him. Her look plainly told him that she understood precisely what he had just done and how much it had cost him. There was sympathy in that look, and a peculiar questioning. Despite Faldor's urgings, Polgara immediately rejected the role of honored guest. It was as if her fingers itched to touch all of the familiar things in the kitchen once more. No sooner had she entered than her cloak went on a peg, an apron went about her waist, and her hands fell to work. Her polite suggestions remained so for almost a full minute and a half before they became commands, and then everything was back to normal again. Faldur and Durnik, their hands clasped behind their backs, strolled about the courtyard looking into storage sheds, talking about the weather and other matters. And Geryon stood in the kitchen doorway with Princess Zenedra.
"Will you show me the farm, Geryon?"
she asked very quietly.
"If you wish." "Does Lady Pogra really like to cook that much?"
She looked across the warm kitchen to where Aunt Paul, humming happily to herself, was rolling out a pie crust.
"I think so," Geryon answered. "Her kitchen's an orderly kind of place. She likes order. Food goes in one end, and supper comes out the other."
He looked around at the low-beamed room with all of the polished pots and pans hanging on the wall. His life seemed to have come full circle.
"I grew up in this room," he said quietly.
"There are worse places to grow up, I suppose." Zenedra's tiny hand crept into his. There was a kind of tentativeness in her touch, almost as if she were not entirely certain how the gesture would be received. There was something peculiar and rather comforting about holding her hand. It was a very small hand. Sometimes Geryon found himself forgetting just how diminutive Zenedra really was. At the moment she seemed very tiny and very vulnerable, and Geryon felt protective for some reason. He wondered if it would be appropriate to put his arm about her shoulder. Together they wandered about the farmstead, looking into barns and stables and hen roosts. Finally they reached the hayloft that had always been Geryon's favorite hiding place.
"I used to come here when I knew that Aunt Paul had work for me to do,"
he confessed with a rueful little laugh.
"Didn't you want to work?"
Zenedra asked him.
"Everybody here seems to be busy every single moment."
"Oh, I don't mind working," Geryon told her. "It's just that some of the things she wanted me to do were pretty distasteful."
"Like scrubbing the pots?"
she asked, her eyes twinkling.
"Well, that's not one of my favorites, no."
They sat together on the soft, fragrant hay in the loft. Zenedra, her fingers now locked firmly in Geryon's, absently traced designs on the back of his hand with her other forefinger.
"You were very brave this afternoon, Geryon,"
she told him seriously.
"Brave?" "You gave up something that's always been very special and very important to you."
"Oh, you mean Zubrat? I think it was for the best, really. Rundrig loves her, and he can take care of her in ways that I probably wouldn't be able to."
"I'm not sure that I understand."
"Zubrat needs a lot of special attention. She's clever and pretty, but she's not really very brave. She used to run away from trouble a lot. She needs someone to watch over her and keep her warm and safe. Somebody who can devote his entire life to her. I don't think I'll be able to do that."
"If you had stayed here at the farm, though, you would have married her, wouldn't you?"
"Probably," he admitted. "But I didn't stay at the farm."
Didn't it hurt? Giving her up like that.
Geryon sighed.
Yes, it did, he said. Sort of. But it was best for all of us, I think. I get a feeling that I'm going to spend a lot of my life traveling about, and Zubret's really not the sort of person you can ask to sleep on the ground. You people never hesitated to ask me to sleep on the ground,
Tenedra pointed out a trifle indignantly. Geryon looked at her.
We didn't, did we? I guess I never thought about that before. Maybe it's because you're braver.
The following morning, after extended farewells and many promises to return, the four of them set out for Sindar.
Well, Geryon,
Aunt Paul said, as they rode across the hill that put Faldor's farm irrevocably behind them.
Well, what?
She gave him a long, silent look. He sighed. There was really not much point in trying to hide things from her.
I won't be able to go back there, will I? No, dear. I guess I always thought that when this was all finished, maybe we could go back to the farm. But we won't, will we? No, Geryon, we won't. You had to see it again to realize it, though. It was the only way to get rid of the little bits and pieces of it that you have been trailing behind you all of these months. I am not saying that Faldor's is a bad place, you understand. It is just that it's not right for certain people. We made the trip all the way up there just so I could find that out. It is fairly important, Geryon. Of course, I enjoyed visiting with Faldor, too, and there were a few special things I left in the kitchen. Things I have had for a very long time, and that I would rather not lose.
A sudden thought had occurred to Geryon, however.
What about Tenedra? Why did you insist that she come along?
Aunt Paul glanced back once at the little princess, who was riding some yards behind them with her eyes lost in thought.
It did not hurt her, and she saw some things there that were important for her to see.
I'm fairly sure that I'll never understand that.
No, dear, probably not.
It snowed fitfully for the next day and a half as they rode along the road, crossing the white central plain toward the capital at Sindar. Though it was not particularly cold, the sky remained overcast and periodic flurries swept in on them as they rode west. Near the coastline, the wind picked up noticeably, and the occasional glimpses of the sea were disquieting. Great waves ran before the wind, their tops ripped to frothy tatters. At King Thorak's palace, they found Belgorath in a foul humor. It was little more than a week until Eris died, and the old man stood glaring out a window at the stormy sea, as if it were all some kind of a vast personal insult.
"So nice that you could join us,"
he said sarcastically to Aunt Paul when she and Geryon entered the room where he brooded.
"Be civil, father,"
she replied calmly, removing her blue cloak and laying it across a chair.
"Do you see what it is doing out there, Paul?"
He jabbed an angry finger toward the window.
"Yes, father,"
she said, not even looking. Instead, she peered intently at his face.
"You aren't getting enough rest,"
she accused him.
"How can I rest with all of that going on?"
He waved at the window again.
"You are just going to agitate yourself, father, and that's bad for you. Try to keep your composure."
"We have to be in Riva by Eristide, Paul."
"Yes, father, I know. Have you been taking your tonic?"
"Oh, there's just no talking with her,"
the old man appealed directly to Geryon. "You can see that, can't you?"
"You don't really expect me to answer a question like that, do you, grandfather? Not right here in front of her."
Belgorath scowled at him. "Turncoat,"
he muttered spitefully. The old man's concern, however, was unfounded. 4 days before Eris died, Captain Greldick's familiar ship sailed into the harbor out of a seething sleet storm. Her masts and bulwarks were coated with ice, and her mainsail was ripped down the center. When the bearded sailor arrived at the palace, he was escorted to the room where Belgarath waited with Captain, now Colonel, Brendig. The sober baronet who had arrested them all in Kamar so many months before. Brendig's rise had been very rapid, and he was now, along with the Earl of Selene, among King Folrak's most trusted advisers.
"Anheg sent me," Greldik reported laconically to Belgarath. "He's waiting at Riva with Rodar and Brand. They were wondering what was keeping you." "I can't find any ship captain willing to venture out of the harbor during this storm," Belgarath replied angrily. "Well, I'm here now. I've got to patch my sail, but that won't take too long," Greldik told him. "We can leave in the morning. Is there anything to drink around here?" "How is the weather out there?" Belgarath asked. "A little choppy." Greldik admitted with an indifferent shrug. He glanced through a window at the 12-foot waves crashing green and foamy against the icy stone wharves in the harbor below. "Once you get out past the breakwater, it's not so bad." "We will leave in the morning, then," Belgarath decided. "You will have 20 or so passengers. Have you got the room?" "We'll make room," Greldik said. "I hope you're not planning to take horses this time. It took me a week to get the bilges clean after that last trip." "Just one," Belgarath replied. "A colt that seems to have become attached to Geryon. He won't make that much mess. Do you need anything?" "I could still use that drink," Greldik replied hopefully. The following morning, the Queen of Sindaria went into hysterics. When she learned that she was going to accompany the party to Riva, Queen Layla went all to pieces. King Folrak's plump little wife had an absolute horror of sea travel, even in the calmest weather. She could not so much as look at a ship without trembling. When Polgara informed her that she had to go with them to Riva, Queen Layla promptly collapsed. "Everything will be all right, Layla," Polgara kept repeating over and over again, trying to calm the agitated little queen. "I won't let anything happen to you." "We'll all drown like rats," Queen Layla wailed in a stark terror. "Like rats! Oh, my poor orphaned children!" "Now stop that at once," Polgara told her. "The sea monsters, they'll eat us all up," the queen added morbidly, "crunching all our bones with their horrid teeth." "There are not any monsters in the Sea of the Winds, Layla," Polgara said patiently. "We have to go. We must be in Riva on Eristide." "Can't you tell them that I'm sick? That I'm dying?" Queen Layla pleaded. "If it would help, I will die. Honestly, Polgara, I'll die right here now on this very spot. Only please, don't make me get on that awful ship. Please." "You are being silly, Layla," Polgara chided her firmly. "You have no choice in the matter. None of us do. You and Folrak and Selene and Brendig all have to go to Riva with the rest of us. That decision was made long before any of you were born. Now stop all of this foolishness and start packing." "I can't," the queen sobbed, flinging herself into a chair. Polgara looked at the panic-stricken queen with a kind of understanding sympathy. But when she spoke, there was no trace of it in her voice. "Get up, Layla," she commanded briskly. "Get on your feet and pack your clothes. You are going to Riva. You will go even if I have to drag you down to the ship and tie you to the mast until we get there." "You wouldn't," Queen Layla gasped, shocked out of her hysteria, as instantly as if she had just been doused with a pail full of cold water. "You wouldn't do that to me, Polgara." "Wouldn't I?" Polgara replied. "I think you had better start packing, Layla." The queen weakly struggled to her feet. "I'll be seasick every inch of the way," she promised. "You can, if it makes you happy, dear,"
Polgara said sweetly, patting the plump little queen gently on the cheek. Chapter 10 They were 2 days at sea from Sindar to Riva, running before a quartering wind with their patched sail booming and the driving spray that froze to everything it touched. The cabin below decks was crowded, and Geryon spent most of his time topside, trying to stay out of the wind and out from under the sailors' feet at the same time. Inevitably, he moved finally to the sheltered spot in the prow, sat with his back against the bulwark and his blue hooded cloak tight about him, and gave himself over to some serious thinking. The ship rocked and pitched in the heavy swells and frequently slammed head-on into monstrous black waves, shooting spray in all directions. The sea around them was flecked with whitecaps, and the sky was a threatening dirty gray. Geryon's thoughts were almost as gloomy as the weather. His life, for the past 15 months, had been so caught up in the pursuit of the orb that he had not had time to look toward the future. Now the quest was almost over, and he began to wonder what would happen once the orb had been restored to the Hall of the Raven King. There would be no longer any reason for his companions to remain together. Barak would return to Val'Alorn. Silk would certainly find some other part of the world more interesting. Hetar and Mandaralan and Relg would return home. And even Sinedra, once she had gone through the ceremony of presenting herself in the throne room, would be called back to Tal Honnoth. The adventure was almost over, and they would all pick up their lives again. They would promise to get together some day and probably be quite sincere about it. But Geryon knew that once they parted, he would never see them all together again. He wondered also about his own life. The visit to Faldur's farm had forever closed that door to him, even if it had ever really been open. The bits and pieces of information he had been gathering for the past year, and more, told him quite plainly that he was not going to be in a position to make his own decisions for quite some time.
"I don't suppose that you would consider telling me what I'm supposed to do next?"
He didn't really expect any kind of satisfactory answer from that other awareness.
"It is a bit premature,"
the dry voice in his mind replied.
"We'll be in Riva tomorrow," Geryon pointed out, "as soon as we put the orb back where it belongs. This part of the adventure will be all finished. Don't you think that a hint or two might be in order along about now?"
"I would not want to spoil anything for you."
"You know, sometimes I think you keep secrets just because you know that it irritates people."
"What an interesting idea."
The conversation got absolutely nowhere after that. It was about noon on the day before Eris died when Greldic's ice-coated ship tacked heavily into the sheltered harbor of the city of Riva on the coast of the Isle of the Winds. A jutting promontory of wind-lashed rock protected the harbor basin and the city itself. Riva, Geryon saw immediately, was a fortress. The wharves were backed by a high, thick city wall, and the narrow, snow-choked gravel strand stretching out to either side of the wharves was also cut off from access to the city. A cluster of makeshift buildings and low, varicolored tents stood on the strand, huddled against the city wall and half buried in snow. Geryon thought he recognized Tol Nidrans and a few Drasnian merchants moving quickly through the little enclave in the raw wind. The city itself rose sharply up the steep slope upon which it was built, each succeeding row of gray stone houses towering over the ones below. The windows facing out toward the harbor were all very narrow and very high up in the buildings, and Geryon could see the tactical advantage of such construction. The terraced city was a series of successive barriers. Breaching the gates would accomplish virtually nothing. Each terrace would be as impregnable as the main wall. Surmounting the entire city and brooding down at it rose the final fortress, its towers and battlements as gray as everything else in the bleak city of the Ravens. The blue and white sword banners of Reva stood out stiffly in the wind above the fortress, outlined sharply against the dark gray clouds scudding across the winter sky. King Anheg of Kerak, clad in fur, and Bran the Riven Warder, wearing his gray cloak, stood on the wharf before the city gates, waiting for them as Graldic's sailors rowed the ship smartly up to the wharf. Beside them, his reddish-gold hair spread smoothly out over his green-cloaked shoulders, stood Lodhran of Wildentor. The young Asturian was grinning broadly. Geryon took one incredulous look at his friend, then with a shout of joy he jumped to the top of the rail and leaped across to the stone wharf. He and Lodhran caught each other in a rough bear hug, laughing and pounding each other on the shoulders with their fists.
"Are you all right?" Geryon demanded. "I mean, did you completely recover and everything?" "I'm as sound as ever," Lodhran assured him with a laugh.
Geryon looked at his friend's face dubiously.
"You would say that even if you were bleeding to death, Lodhran." "No, I am really fine," the Asturian protested. "The young sister of Baron Otrain leached the Algroth poison from my veins with poultices and vile-tasting potions and restored me to health with her art. Oh, she's a marvelous girl."
His eyes glowed as he spoke of her.
"What are you doing here in Riva?" Geryon demanded. "Lady Spogra's message reached me last week," Lodhran explained. "I was still at Baron Otrain's castle."
He coughed a bit uncomfortably.
"For one reason or another, I had kept putting off my departure. When her instruction to travel to Riva with all possible haste reached me, I left at once. Surely you knew about the message?"
"This is the first I'd heard of it," Geryon replied, looking over to where Aunt Paul, followed by Queen Silar and Queen Layla, were stepping down from the ship to the wharf.
"Where's Rodar?" Hohag was asking King Anheg. "He stayed up at the citadel," Anheg shrugged. "There isn't really that much point to his hauling that paunch of his up and on the steps to the harbor any more than he has to."
"How is he?" King Thorak asked.
"I think he has lost some weight," Anheg replied. "The approach of fatherhood seems to have had some impact on his appetite."
"When's the child due?"
Queen Layla asked seriously.
"I really could not say, Layla," the King of Kerak told her. "I have trouble keeping track of things like that. Porin had to stay at Bokhtor, though. I guess she's too far along to travel. Eileen is here, though."
"I need to talk with you, Geryon,"
Lodhran said nervously.
"Of course."
Geryon led his friend several yards down the snowy pier, away from the turmoil of disembarking.
"I am afraid that Lady Polgra is going to be cross with me, Geryon,"
Lodhran said quietly.
"Why cross?"
Geryon said it suspiciously.
"Well," Lodhran hesitated. "A few things went wrong along the way, sort of." "What exactly are we talking about when we say went wrong, sort of?" "I was at Baron Otrain's castle," Lodhran began. "Well, I got that part. Arianna, the Lady Arianna, that is, Baron Otrain's sister, the blonde membrane girl who nursed you back to health." "Ah, so you remember her?"
Lodhran sounded very pleased about that.
"Do you remember how lovely she is? How—"
"I think we're getting away from that point, Lodhran," Geryon said firmly. "We were talking about why Aunt Paul's going to be cross with you."
"Oh, I'm getting to it, Geryon. Well, to put it briefly, Arianna and I have become, well, friends?"
"I see."
"Oh, nothing improper, you understand," Lodhran said quickly. "But our friendship was such that, well, we did not want to be separated."
The young Asturian's face appealed to his friend for understanding.
"Actually, it was a bit more than did not want to. Arianna told me that she would die if I left her behind."
"Possibly she was exaggerating," Geryon suggested.
"But how could I risk it, though?
Lelderon protested.
Women are so much more delicate than we are. Besides, Ariana's a physician. She would know if she would die, would she not?
I'm sure she would, Garion sighed. Why don't you just plunge on with the story, Lelderon? I think I'm ready for the worst now.
It's not that I really meant any harm,
Lelderon said plaintively.
Of course not. In their way, Ariana and I left the castle very late one evening. I knew the knight on guard at the drawbridge, so I hit him over the head because I did not want to hurt him.
Garion blinked.
I knew that he would be honor-bound to try to stop us,
Lelderon explained.
I did not want to have to kill him, so I hit him over the head.
I suppose that makes sense, Garion said dubiously.
Arion is almost positive that he will not die.
Die?
I hit him just a little too hard, I think.
The others had all disembarked and were preparing to follow Brand and King Unheg up the steep, snow-covered stairs toward the upper levels of the city.
So that's why you think Aunt Paul might be cross with you?
Garion said, as he and Lelderon fell in at the rear of the group.
Well, that is not exactly the whole story, Garion,
Lelderon admitted.
A few other things happened, too.
Such as what?
Well, they chased us a little, and I had to kill a few of their horses.
I see.
I specifically aimed my arrows at the horses and not at the men. It was not my fault that Baron Alterain could not get his foot clear of the stirrup, was it?
How badly was he hurt? Garion was almost resigned by now.
Oh, nothing serious at all. At least I do not think so. A broken leg, perhaps. The one he broke before, when Sir Maundor Allan unhorsed him?
Go on, Garion told him.
Well, the priest did have it coming, though,
Lelderon declared hotly.
What priest? The priest of Caldan at that little chapel who would not marry us because Ariana could not give him a document proving that she had her family's consent. He was very insulting.
Did you break anything?
Oh, a few of his teeth is about all. And I stopped hitting him as soon as he agreed to perform the ceremony.
And so you are married. Congratulations. I'm sure you'll both be very happy. Just as soon as they let you out of prison. Lelderon drew himself up.
It is a marriage and name only, Garion. I would never take advantage of it. You know me better than that. We reasoned that Ariana's reputation might suffer if it became known that we were traveling alone like that. The mirage was just for the sake of appearances.
As Lelderon described his disastrous journey through Arendia, Garion glanced curiously at the city of Riva. There was a kind of unrelieved bleakness about its snow-covered streets. The buildings were all very tall, and were of a uniform gray color. The few evergreen boughs, wreaths, and brightly hued buntings hung in celebration of that Erstide season seemed somehow to accentuate the stiff grimness of the city. There were, however, some very interesting smells coming from the kitchens, where Erastide feasts simmered and roasted under the watchful eyes of the women of Reva.
That was all of it, then?
Garion asked his friend. You stole Baron Alterain's sister, married her without his consent, broke his leg, and assaulted several of his people and a priest. That was everything that happened?
Well, not exactly.
Lelderon's face was a bit pained. There's more?
I did not really mean to hurt Torresin.
Your cousin? Lelderon nodded moodily.
Ariana and I took refuge at my uncle Reldigan's house, and Torresin made some remarks about Ariana. She is a membrane, after all, and Torresin's very prejudiced. My remonstrances were quite temperate, I thought, all things considered. But after I knocked him down the stairs, nothing would satisfy him but a duel. You killed him?
Geryon asked in a shocked voice.
Of course I did not kill him. All I did was run him through the leg, just a little bit. How can you run somebody through just a little bit, Lulderin?
Geryon demanded of his friend in exasperation.
Oh, you are disappointed in me, are you not, Geryon?
The young Astorian seemed almost on the verge of tears. Geryon rolled his eyes skyward and gave up.
No, Lulderin, I'm not disappointed. A little startled, perhaps, but not really disappointed. Was there anything else you can remember? Anything you might have left out? Well, I hear that I've sort of been declared an outlaw in Arendia. Sort of. The crown has put a price on my head,
Lulderin admitted.
Or so I understand.
Geryon began to laugh helplessly.
A true friend would not laugh at my misfortunes,
the young man complained, looking injured.
You managed to get into that much trouble in just a week? Well, none of it was really my fault, Geryon. Things just got out of hand, that is all. Do you think Lady Bulgara is going to be angry?
I'll talk to her,
Geryon assured his impulsive young friend.
Maybe if she and Mandorallan appeal to King Corradulin, they can get him to take the price off your head.
Is it true that you and Sir Mandorallan destroyed the Murgo Nechak and all of his henchmen in the throne room at Vomimbre?
Lulderin asked suddenly.
I think the story might have gotten a bit garbled,
Geryon replied.
I denounced Nechak, and Mandorallan offered to fight him to prove that what I said was true. Nechak's men attacked Mandorallan, then, and Barak and Hetar joined in. Hetar's the one who actually killed Nechak. We did manage to keep your name, and Torreson's, out of it.
You are a true friend, Geryon.
Here? Barak was saying. What is she doing here?
She came with Aglaena and me, King Anheg replied.
Did she?
Anheg nodded. Your son is with her, and your daughters. His birth seems to have mellowed her a bit.
What does he look like?
Barak asked eagerly.
He is a great red-haired brute of a boy,
Anheg laughed.
And when he gets hungry, you can hear him yell for a mile.
Barak grinned rather foolishly. When they reached the top of the stairs and came out into the shallow square before the great hall, two rosy-cheeked little girls in green cloaks were waiting impatiently for them. They both had long reddish-blonde braids and seemed to be only slightly older than Erend.
Papa?
The youngest of the two squealed, running to Barak. The huge man caught her up in his arms and kissed her soundly. The second girl, a year or so older than her sister, joined them with a show of dignity, but was also swept up in her father's embrace.
My daughters,
Barak introduced the girls to the rest of the party.
This is Gundred.
He poked his great red beard into the face of the eldest girl, and she giggled as his whiskers tickled her face.